Well, hey there, everybody. Welcome to Cambridge Inside Out. My name's Robert Winters, and you're not. Meanwhile, over there in the other box on this, in the secret square, we have...
Well, how do you know they're not Robert Winters? They could be a Robert Winters out there watching. My name is Patrick Barrett.
By the way, there's a woman in Cambridge named Pam Winters whose father was named Robert Winters. So I think
one of the reasons...
We used to joke because she was on the planning board and she would always refer to me as her ex. and I would do the same. We kind of had a running gag. It was fun, actually. Yeah, so anyway, it was pretty cool. So anyway, we actually canceled the show from a couple of weeks ago. And for the most pathetic of all reason, yours truly was still working on his taxes right up to the bell. So, but I got him in this time, which is really miraculous. So that was
you cool. Pay your taxes?
I pay your taxes.
I didn't have to do that.
Apparently I'm paying your taxes too. So
I paid mine last year. I'm good.
Actually, I still haven't filed the paperwork from last year, so that's my one undone task. You know, I vowed I would never do an extension on filing of taxes, and then COVID kicked in, and I started doing really lazy things like that. So I'm playing catch up now, but I'll catch up.
IRS agents who are watching, Robert Winters lives on Broadway somewhere in Cambridge.
Nothing. I got nothing to hide. Definitely got nothing to hide. So, I thought maybe it would be a good thing to just mention a few things relating to Central Square.
I've heard of the place.
The center of the universe. And I thought the first thing to mention was really just a statement on the passing of John Clifford. Yeah. John Clifford, and we've been friends. We've been not friends. So I want to be really upfront about that over the years.
That's a very Cambridge relationship, by the way.
It is a very Cambridge relationship, but John was the owner operator of Green Street Grill. And I remember going back and spending a lot of time at a Green Street Grill back in the 1980s, when I think Johnny was the guy who served up this really hot Jamaican food and stuff in there. And I used to belly up to the bar there pretty regularly. It was actually a pretty great place. In no small part due to the efforts of John Clifford to define the place. It was great. And I want to mention a few other people about Central Square here, but many people knew John as really a close friend of Ken Reeves. Sometimes when Ken Reeves and I were on the outs, that meant, John and I were on the outs too, because.
Ken and I have been best friends since day one, so don't worry about that.
Right.
As a newbie coming to Cambridge, because I wasn't born here, or they come in the Mayflower. I knew John as, and he can correct me, Robert, as like the architect for something called the World's Fair.
That is absolutely correct. The Central Square World's Fair. And it was a lot of the international foods that were really featured on the Central Square World's Fair. I went to many of them. I have the t-shirts to prove it. And it was a really great tradition. It was really sort of a sad thing that went away. But nowadays we've got the Business Improvement District. So we've basically made what was a great start into a really a great, pretty much, I hope, more permanent sort of arrangement for making good things happen in Central Square. But one other thing I want to say about John, especially in light of the fact that we were not always on the best of sides, he had a quality just like some other of my best friends have, which is that they know how to stick up for their friends. And sometimes maybe that's not the best thing, but the thing is that he was very much that way. And he was a friend, a supporter, and a defender of Ken Reeves. And Ken Reeves is one of the other really big names that should go down in history as one of the great promoters of Central Square back in the times before it was fashionable, I think that really needs to be acknowledged. I mean, I'm sort of a booster for quite a few people. I just was writing a few names of the people who I've interacted with over the years, who played a big role in the sort of enhancement of Central Square. John Clifford, Ken Reeves is definitely amongst them. Carl Barron, with all his goods and bad attributes, he was always a person who was there. Norm MacIver, Arnold Goldstein was a wonderful fellow that I got along with really well. Bob Bulris, Geneva Malenfant. And in the more modern day, Patrick Barrett, Michael Monestime, and always Joseph and Nabil Sater. So now I'm sure I missed a lot of really great people there, but I just felt like I wanted to at least mention a few folks who I think have been pretty pivotal here.
It's very kind of you to put me and Mike in that kind of company.
Well, you know, the thing is back in the 1990s when I was on something called the Central Square Committee, which was different than the Central Square Advisory Committee, we, you know, those are the days when we first talked about creating a business improvement district. And, you know, we talked about it 20 plus years passed. And it took a couple of young gentlemen by the name of Barrett Monestine to sort of make a little magic happen. They weren't the only ones, I'm sure. There were others who were involved in making it all happen. And you had to get buy-in from the property owners ultimately as well. But honestly, you know, it really still comes down to the initiative and the energy of a few key individuals to actually make good things happen. It doesn't just happen by process. You know, so I think it's important to at least remember the individuals.
Not much that is good in Cambridge comes through process, if I can recall, having been a member and part of committees and many processes. I can say definitively that, I have never been part of a city process that yielded anything.
I have been part of city processes over the years that yielded good ideas, some of which were carried through and some of which ended up being modified in somewhat reasonable ways. On the other hand, I was also part of this Envision Cambridge process where there were some good ideas that came out of that, but you know, a few years passed and pretty much everybody's just making it up like with little one-offs now, you know? And you know, it's sort of like all that notion about process and planning just seems to have been forgotten. And well, that's becoming kind of the way of things.
We went from over process, multiple studies, to no process. There's no happy medium. Like we did the Red Ribbon Commission, which was, you know, David Marr started that, but Ken Reeves is really the reason why that had happened. Into C2, almost 4 years of constant conversations and committees, and then nothing. And now we have like an AHO amendment for something that was just recently passed a couple of years ago and whether you support it or whether you're against it is, you know, whatever, I don't really care. It's just that what process can you point to that was the result that yielded that?
Well, I can speak to that a little bit about not to obsess so much on the AHO. I've never been a fan of the whole concept of it.
Be careful, Robert, be careful. You can't say that you don't like the AHO. I'm going to have to cancel you myself.
In my feeling, in spite of any meritorious ideas that people may have about it, to me, zoning should be zoning. If you say this is what we want buildings to be, then that should be it. And it shouldn't be different rules for different parties. You know, I have never been a fan of having different rules for different people. You know, we all play by the same rules. So, and if you don't like the rules, you change the rules.
I love it when I get to disagree with you a little bit because I feel like we agree too much. So I like to at least have some conflict. But I think that the AHO serves a public good, which is the entire purpose of zoning. However, you know, I think it's overlooked that the sort of unintended consequences of the AHO. Like right now we're talking about 15 story buildings in all the squares down from 25, which, you know, take it or leave it. But the word that I'm hearing from people who are supporting it are that, you know, that's now the cap for buildings. So if you were to build a market rate building, which is arguably the only feasible type of construction that can go above six stories, you can't. So to my mind, there's just an amazing amount of intellectual inconsistency in the city. And that, to my mind, that's where I kind of get derailed in the conversation when I say I don't really know what you're trying to achieve.
Well, what I don't particularly like is sort of the way this is interwoven with local politics. All right. Mm-hmm. So if you happen to be a group like the A Better Cambridge group, you know, I don't think they've ever made a secret. In fact, it was even in their early platforms that they were going to push for certain changes to what they could get through. And then use that to leverage what they ultimately wanted to get through. And ultimately, they, you know, for whether you like it or not, they just want to have a bigger, denser city. You know, there's absolutely nothing else associated with that group other than they want a bigger, denser city. I've never heard anyone from that association express any point of view about schools, roads, bridges,
the school
public welfare, anything.
The school thing's another story, Robert. I have to say, like, this city, for all its bluster, largely ignores schools and kids. So like, it's not just ABC that's guilty of that. And I think a lot of them don't even have children. So they're like, we don't know. Or there's somebody else that will weigh in on that. But the ABC guys, which I mean, give or take, to my mind, it's just like ABC, Cambridge Residents Alliance, you know, the People's Popular Front. Who the hell, I mean, it's all the same shit. Pardon my Italian. But the...
What I don't like it is when the activity of political groups gets interwoven with the political fortunes of candidates and incumbents.
I think you get a sense right now that like if there was a group of people in Cambridge, say like 200 citizens, that were the people for horses and buggies to come back as the primary mode of transportation, that there would be a policy order from the council shortly thereafter to reinstate the horse and buggy. So like, it all seems like where the wind blows, this is where we goes, you know?
Well, you know, I actually am, I've been around and following things long enough to remember a day when elected officials actually worked in concert with city departments and city departments worked in concert with elected officials. And they didn't do it behind the scenes. It was all pretty much up there, out in the open, you know? So the thing is, if there was a desire to increase the tax base and community development, part of their function of community development was to actually do that. Nobody was hiding from that fact. You know, it was there for anyone to see. And, you know, and I thought that was all right. What I have not, I can't say I'm at all a fan about the way that when significant public policy proposed, especially things having to do with zoning, but not exclusively that, just sort of get hatched up behind the scenes, almost as a private conversation between some individuals or an organization and a few city councilors. You know, I mean, I actually enjoyed serving on, you know, Library 21 committee, the technical working committee for the computerization of the Cambridge elections, the Green Ribbon Open Space Committee. You know, I've been on and then eventually Envision Cambridge. Right now, if you ask me, Robert, would you like to be part of one of these sort of city processes right now? I'd say, I don't know if I would, because I don't know that anybody's listening. And I think that, you know, city staff and the political people are pretty much driving the buggy. So.
Well, I think to your point, what I noticed, having served serious time on Red Ribbon and C2, and even the mayor's Blue Ribbon Commission on Tenant Advocacy, is that they have the conclusion. They know what the answer is. What they're doing is they're trying to put human bodies, residents' bodies, in a position of ballast to sort of give weight to their arguments when they present it to the council, saying, well, you know, I think Buto is a good example of that. I think more recently, you look at the bike lane sort of conversation is very similar to that, where, you know, there we had 20 people show up and say they love this.
Right.
Mission accomplished.
Well, you know, one other thing, just to deviate a little bit from the point, though, is that it just seems to me nowadays that, you know, the art of compromise is largely thrown away. You know,
compromise is weakness now, Robert. It's weakness.
Compromise is weakness now. We're basically being given binary choices. So like you're in Cambridge, you're either a gung-ho advocate for, you know, 25-story residential towers, or you're an evil NIMBY who's just trying to drive out anybody other than the millionaires out of the city.
Slow down, Robert. You're not just a NIMBY, you're a racist.
Exactly. Now, I actually think that there's a tremendous amount of room in between those two extremes for some very interesting ideas. You know, I have very strongly of the opinion that we can definitely build more housing and we can do it in a lot of interesting and creative ways here. But it doesn't necessarily mean it has to be done according to one plan. I think you can achieve bicycle safety in a lot of ways that are far more nuanced than just drilling plastic posts into the ground and putting a concrete barriers everywhere.
It's interesting because they just had a recent report on the bicycle lanes themselves where I guess there's some statistical evidence that they haven't really reduced accidents. And they said they've increased them, although I think that that's a little bit skewed because you have more bike riders. But I believe the phrase was vision zero, not vision maybe a few. You know, yeah, so.
But in that great gray area of that is reality, it seems people often forget, you know, there's plenty of room to at least acknowledge the fact, like, for example, on the bicycle issue, that most of the serious hazards for bicycling has to do with intersections. which is where bike lanes stop because traffic has to cross, right? So the thing is, there's a tremendous amount of effort put into what I would say would be the sort of the least important aspects of bicycle safety. You know,
well, if we got rid of all the cars, Robert, and we got rid of the buses, and we got rid of, I guess, anything with wheels and an engine. I'm not sure if scooters are in that category, but I feel threatened by them. Then maybe that's the solution. And I think we need to work on that. No more cars.
You know, they're actually, if you leave the bounds of Cambridge, I know this is a hard thing for many to do, but, you know, in places like Medford, they actually were investigating things like what they call bicycle boulevards, or you could put bicycle priority streets. You could allow certain streets which are actually would remain somewhat more as thoroughfares for motor vehicles, which is a pretty good thing if you need to get a fire engine or an ambulance through, for goodness sake. You know, but then you can actually focus more on just building up a good network. You know, and it doesn't have to be 100% all the ways. You know, that's one of the things I've never really quite understood. But anyway, I don't know what's true in terms of this statistical study that basically said there's been more accidents since with the building of some of these lanes. The argument against that, people say, as you pointed out, I think correctly, is that, well, that's because there are more people using them. So, of course, those numbers might go up. So the question is, on a sort of a per unit basis, is it safer or not?
I go back to the original argument for them, which was vision zero. So, like, if not vision, a couple of people or a couple more people. This is where, like, it becomes the political versus the rational. And we have a saying, only the Sith deal in absolutes, me and my Jedi friends. But like, that's where we are right now, where the conversation, I just left a meeting at City Hall about economic development, and which brought up the bike lanes, which brought up the impacts. And right now the political tenor is, if you're for the bike lanes, you get like 2 woke merit badges and like a brownie. And if you're against them, you are absolutely 100% unequivocally pro car murder, which there's no home for anybody in that conversation.
Right. And, you know, I think as a lot of people learned the hard way, there are plenty of circumstances where instituting bike lanes, even if we feel those are good things, will have some negative consequences. What I don't particularly like is the absolutist zeal of some of the advocates. I think the one example I love to give was, because this actually happened, it was on one of these, it was a Nextdoor, social media things. And Nextdoor is becoming a pretty toxic place.
It's a nasty place.
Well, what happens with, it happened with Usenet back in the 80s and 90s, they eventually sort of turn into sewers of just, you know, people who just like to bitch and moan. You know, or hold on with such zeal to their never bending point of view that they just become obnoxious pains in the butt, you know. But one of the people was pointing out that, you know, well, if you have something like St. John's Church on North Mass Ave, you know, and you put in a bike lane so you can't allow any vehicles in front, I said, well, what does that mean? Well, I think they actually have a little driveway up there, but if let's say it's another church, and there's a wedding or a funeral and they want to pull a hearse up there, but there's a bike lane in there. And one person on Nextdoor actually says, well, they can just pull into the parking lot up the street. Yeah, and carry the body down the sidewalk into the church. I said, are you really serious? But that's the kind of zealot that is being promoted these days.
So internet activism, Robert, isn't activism. And these people who go on Nextdoor, they go on Twitter, they go on all these other places, and they're just there for the endorphin rush or the human contact, whether it be positive or negative, to sort of drive the bus. And the reality is that every single one of those people, and I will say this as a definitive, 100% absolute Sith-like statement, should spend the money and sit on the couch for 10 sessions and get it out of their system, because that's what this is a substitute for.
I think I'm going to have to agree with you. But you know something, it's funny, like whether it's Twitter, Facebook, whatever, these, they all become sort of forums for idiocy, inevitably. Even no matter how you start out, I actually thought, you know, C Click Fix or Commonwealth Connect, sort of a good thing. Originally started out as something for reporting things like potholes, or, you know, they mixed my garbage collection and whatever. And, you know, and somebody's going to pick up on it. And then, you know, eventually a truck will come by and fix it, fix whatever needs to be fixed, right? But it became just another social media outlet where people get into fights over stupid things like bike lanes and stuff.
Well, go ahead.
Sorry. No, and actually on the C-Click Fix, you know, because I get these notices all the time. And it's like the same four or five people are the ones who are filing all the complaints. So whether you're Lonely Ted or Captain Cyclist, or one of these other characters, you know, basically you're sitting there, you're a person who has no life whatsoever, but, you know, you get really, really pissed off when that armored vehicle pulls up in front of the bank with no other option, right? And then you are going to sort of say, he has to be ticketed and towed.
Well, the real problem, Robert, is capitalism. That bank shouldn't exist. That guy shouldn't have a job, and that gun should be not in his pocket. But the C-Click Fix thing, I had a certain city council aide who shall not be named, used to like to write up my building with some frequency until he figured out that he was actually writing up my next door neighbor. So it's ripe for that. But one thing I did notice was kind of interesting in that Monday night city council, 42 speakers. Monday night, the previous week, 42 speakers. And I'm sitting here going, I guarantee, like, the Venn diagram of the people who are nightmares on next door, the people who are nightmares on all these places converge and make a perfect circle for public comment at City Hall. And I'm saying that as someone who is a somewhat frequent flyer there, but, like, I saw the toxicity and all that stuff, and I ejected from every single social media platform. But, like, when it seeps into the public discourse and it's in the Sullivan Chamber, which is where we are now in the council. I think the council they feel like they're reading the tea leaves on social media and bringing that into the Sullivan Chamber. They need to be maybe a policy order to limit their own interactions on those platforms to clear their minds, because none of it's real. Twitter is not a real place.
Maybe some of our city councils are just not very good at math. You know, they see that the 42 people who show up every week, and or they see that maybe the total of 200 people who basically involved in all the civic activity, and they go, well, that's the whole city, isn't it?
It must be. It must be. Yeah. I also thought, like, you know, a couple of takeaways from, and I'm sorry, I know we're not trying to add substance to your show, but
God forbid.
Take away the I walked out of this meeting with economic development talking about the impacts on small businesses, and what two things just kind of stuck out to me. One, the city never intended to send that study out to begin with. Paul Toner was the reason why they even did it, and they copied and pasted the residential study. So at no point in time was the city like, we should probably check in on businesses. Two, the two groups that got the highest ratings, 80% and 70% for satisfactory level, was the police and the fire department.
Shocking, isn't it?
And everyone else got like 50% or below. The closest was a 59%, which I believe is kind of a conflated number for governance. But, you know, this police and the fire department are getting passing grades, and the city is getting a big fat F.
Well, and our city councilors, when you actually add up the sort of the rhetoric of some of the city councilors, when you think about fire department, whether it's Councilor Nolan basically trying to audition for to be the purchasing agent for the fire department, or Quentin Zondervan, who wants to be the purchasing agent for the police department. By the way, neither of you are going to get the job, right? Nor should you.
I mean, I think it might be kind of funny to let Quentin do it for a day just to see what he does. Like, you know, only, stickers and jelly beans for the police, and the fire department gets like a plastic bucket. But I think there's a real disconnect between the general population of the city and what the city's presenting to the council. Because the city presented that study as if it was like a glowing favorable rating for the city.
You know, this relates to a much larger issue, which we could go on for hours about, which is that in a city where though some of us do our best to try and get information in and out, or, you know, to residents in the city, it's a real heavy lift. without a serious paper record. So the thing is, we don't really have a common water cooler around which the people in the city gather in any routine way to actually find out what's truth and what's bullshit. You know, and that is a serious problem right now. So the thing is, in an environment like that, what can happen is social media influencers can basically say, they can just talk trash. And we have witless elected officials who will, or I believe, are just incapable of distinguishing fact from fiction.
Well, you know? I think it's a little bit, and I don't want to give the council any credit, but I don't think that they're dumb. I don't think that these people are just bereft of any intelligence. But I do think that they are concerned about keeping their jobs. And I think they're concerned about getting reelected. And so our council spends a lot of time trying to do political math to see, well, if I say 15 stories, does that get me 5 more votes? If I say I like a bike lane, does that get me 2 more votes? If I'm a big, to my mind, it's a giant feedback loop of nonsense, because the council's reacting to the nonsense on social media, the nonsense that the 5 people who show up at the city hall, and pretending as if that's somehow where the city wants to go. I bet you if we went door to door and asked them asked people in the city of Cambridge what Buto is, they'd be like, what the hell is a Buto? Right. And you tell them what it was, they'd be like, the city did that?
Speaking of this sort of the one-upmanship competition, and we're sort of in our last minute before the break here, but I think it was during the Jan Devereaux years. So it used to be 30 mile per hour speed limit in thickly settled areas. And then they said, well, I think we ought to lower it to 25. And then there was a flurry of council activity. Well, I think we ought to lower it to 20. And I'm surprised it didn't get down to 5, you know. But that's the sort of competition that they do. Whatever they think is going to be viewed as the most virtuous, you know, Vision Zero-esque kind of position.
Not a single life shall be harmed, Robert, on our streets. And only the council, can prevent it from happening.
Absolutely true. So anyway, we're down to our last 8 seconds here. So with that note, we're going to come back here in just a few minutes and talk brilliance here on Cambridge
Inside Out. With a lot more swearing.
See you then.